Welcome to the New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, the New Mind Creator. Today, I'll be interviewing Coach Jonathan McLaren. Please make sure to hit the subscribe button so that you receive alerts when new episodes are available on Sundays at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You know, Coach John, I know you enjoy basketball as well. I love all sports. But sports could also be likened unto life because we have to be able to work with others. We have to have discipline. And we get that exhilaration, that feeling of exhilaration once we accomplish a goal together. Because we are all interconnected. It's just that it looks like we are separate because of the different expressions, but yet we are all interconnected.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I love this, you know, the saying that no man is an island. And I think somewhere along the way, maybe late in the 20th century, we sort of fell in love with this idea of the self-made individual. And I think that's probably one of the most harmful sort of fallacies that we've come across, because even the idea that we're better off alone, or that we should take pride in that we've accomplished something by ourselves without the help of others. And of course, it's not true. Another expression I often think of is we're standing on the shoulders of giants, right? We're here today because of the work of others who've gone before us. And so when we start to open our eyes to that reality, we realize how important it is to forge powerful and meaningful connections with others around us.
Yes, it's very important to make those connections. Where did you grow up?
I grew up just outside of a city called Vancouver in Canada. So it's on the west coast, right on the ocean there. Interesting, I was born at 26 weeks. So I missed about 14 weeks of pregnancy. So I spent the first couple months of my life on an incubator in the neonatal intensive care unit. And it was sort of touch and go whether or not I was going to make it. But as evidenced by the fact that I'm here today, I did, in fact, beat the odds.
You definitely did.
You
definitely did. So, you know, growing up, I know, you know, Canada is different than the U.S. in some ways. How would you describe that childhood?
Largely, I'd say it was quite a happy one. I think I'm really fortunate in the regard that I grew up, my parents had a stable and pretty happy marriage. Like it was a challenge in one sense because, you know, we went through quite a few, what I would call lean years. You know, I try to put a careful qualifier in there, say we grew up first world poor. I recognize that we grew up in Canada, which is a privileged country, but there were definitely years where we struggled to make ends meet. I know there was years where our income was below the poverty line, and my dad was a business owner in a variety of contexts. And so business tended to be up and down, a little bit unpredictable. But the one thing that was stable through all of this, I have one older brother, is that like we had a loving family, and we did a lot of things together, whether it was, you know, going out hiking, whether it was playing sports. Like, so with whatever we had, we made the most of it. And I think there's just, it goes back to the sort of human connection piece. And, you know, our family is kind of the first piece of that puzzle.
You had a really traumatic experience when you were in South Africa. Could you tell how you know, how you even got to South Africa?
Yeah. So it's kind of a bit of a crazy story. We, because, I previously was a nanotechnology engineer, and then I spent some time as a marine engineer in the Navy. But I got tired of the military and kind of the politics of it. And so and this is the Canadian Navy. So I came home to my wife one day and said, you know, why don't we just, you know, everyone talks about traveling the world. Why don't we just start? And that would have been about October of 2009. And by January of 2010, we were on a plane. And we flew down to Mexico, spent about 6 months living down there, teaching English there. And we actually met a gentleman from South Africa, and we kind of forged a friendship with him. We ended up going over to Italy and to Poland over the next kind of year. And he actually came and joined us in Poland as well to teach for a while. And he said to us, well, you know, why don't you come down to South Africa? My parents run this nonprofit organization. They teach and educate underprivileged youth and kind of help with this unemployment crisis that we have in South Africa. And we said, yeah, that sounds very exciting. And so it was end of July 2011. We ended up flying down to South Africa and to sort of start out in this new adventure here. We'd already been about, I guess, a year and a half into our sort of world travels at that time. And so, yeah, we got down to South Africa. We were teaching on a nature reserve down there. So it was, you know, a few hundred hectares. They had some rhinos and giraffes and monkeys and things like that. Yeah, they had an educational facility, a dormitory for students to stay in, as well as we had like a little instructor's cabin that was sort of nestled away off to the side. And so we started teaching young people, and we were kind of really teaching them how to communicate. It wasn't really just teaching English, but it was teaching communication skills in a professional setting, because a lot of them, English is a second or a third language. We were teaching, you know, hospitality specific skills and whatnot. So we, as well as just how to work cohesively with others, because in South Africa, there's many different ethnic groups. Even within the Black community, there's about 8 different ethnic groups, as well as there's the South Asians, the Coloreds, the Afrikaans, and the English. So South Africa is kind of this fractured country where there's a lot of sort of discord between all of these different groups. It's not just, not even just a racial thing, it's a cultural thing. And so we would bring these groups of people together from all these various groups, and get them working together cohesively. And it was really quite a beautiful thing to see. And after they would spend some time with us, they would get placed into internships in the hospitality industry, and basically learn how to employ the skills that we had imparted on them during the time we were working together with them.
Can you describe the experience that you had?
Yeah, absolutely. So we did about 2 weeks instructing at this point in time, and there was just one night. It was a Monday night, and I was walking back from the dining hall where everybody was, that was kind of the furthest building away, over to the instructor's cabin. And when I got there, the door was slightly ajar, and that should have, you know, triggered something in my brain, but it didn't, because I'm like, we're on a nature reserve, we're 45 minutes away from a city, like, there's no reason to, you know, be on guard. Like there's nobody out here. There's rangers on the reserve, that kind of thing. And when I opened the door, there was 3 men inside the cabin, and they were actually sitting at a table. They were drinking rooibos tea, which is a common tea that's consumed in South Africa, and eating our rusks, which is kind of this hard biscuit that you would dip in your tea. And, still at first I was like, was there something wrong in our cabin? Were you fixing something? Like, because I actually recognized one of the men as one of the rangers, but there was actually a fourth man outside the cabin that I didn't see. And, as I was sort of trying to put two and two together and figure out like what the heck is going on here, I got hit across the head with a rock. And, you know, that first sort of hit across the skull, I kind of, you know, then all of a sudden I'm stunned. I'm like, what is happening here? Like, trying to, again, kind of, I think there might have been an element of denial, just trying to figure out what's going on. And the other three, they jumped up. I remember one of them grabbing me by the collar of the shirt, and he's swinging this rock at my head again. I get cracked over the head again. And, you know, blood just starts pouring, because the forehead bleeds pretty easily. You know, blood just starts pouring down my face, and I get knocked down. I'm pretty stunned at this point, like a couple of hits over the head with the rock, and, you know, I'm seeing stars. And they weren't just love taps here. They were swinging to do damage. And so they started really like kicking and stomping, and I thankfully I was able to kind of fight my way to my feet, because I'm a pretty big guy, and you know, I've been screaming for help, but nobody was hearing me, because they were all, you know, a couple hundred feet away in this dining hall. Just they're all talking away, having a good time, whatever, totally unaware of the fact that I'm sitting here trying to fight for my life and these guys are trying to beat me to death. And so I managed to kind of break free from them and kind of stagger, stumble my way over to the dining hall. And for some reason, they didn't pursue me. And I don't know why, but that was probably one of my saving graces, you know. And I got to the dining hall, and you know, my face is covered in blood, and I'm like, I've been attacked. There's at least four men out there. I don't know how many are out there. Kind of the pandemonium ensued at this point, as all of a sudden it's like, okay, where are all the students? I'm kind of stunned. Like, my wife was the one that was doing all of this, and I tell you what, she was incredibly brave in all of this experience. You know, rounded everybody up, made sure that they're in a reasonably safe place. You know, we put a fridge against one of the doors. We started boiling water, put some tables and chairs against some of the other doors. All the doors in the building down there did have bars over the glass and whatnot. And then, you know, these men were definitely trying to break them down. And it was probably about 45 minutes before the police actually arrived, because down in South Africa, the police tend to be, well, for lack of a better term, inept and corrupt. And they're the lower level police, really, their goal is just to collect a paycheck and stay out of harm's way. It was kind of a lucky break that there happened to be a senior officer walking past a phone that rang, and one of our students happened to have her cell phone, and we happened to have like one bar of signal and so on. But the challenge is really, like, as they drive onto the reserve, you actually go down through a valley and come back up. And so you can actually see across the valley, and it was nighttime, and you could see the flashing lights of the police car when, you know, they're at least still 15 to 20 minutes away from actually getting to our location. And so these men kind of just melted into the bush. And the police get out there, and they're like, okay, nobody died, nobody got raped, cool, we're going to leave now. And thankfully, again, because I was still just, I don't know, I was seeing stars, I was stunned, I was trying to process all of that. I didn't really know where I was or what was going on, probably concussed at this point. And my wife was like, no, you're not leaving. Like, these men tried to kill my husband, and they actually did murder a guy the night before. Like, this was their intent. And anyways, they found a knife. One of the police officers just grabbed it barehanded, picked it up. So just contaminated the evidence. Like, there was just no interest in really trying to do any of the work. And so, but anyways, we said, you're staying here until we get our drivers out here to get all of us, including all of our students, off here. None of us are staying here tonight because these men are out there. Anyway, so that was that. And then there's kind of the fallout from that. So nothing in life, I think, really prepares us to go through trauma or deal with trauma. And for myself, I ended up turning to food as a way of kind of medicating my trauma. And so it's, you know, more socially acceptable than drugs or alcohol. Because after going through trauma, there's a lot of flashbacks, reliving the experience, trying to rewrite the narrative, lots of random emotions, lots of random triggers. It's just a really, like, terrible and horrible place to be mentally. And one of the ways sort of around that a little bit was to eat, and eat a lot of food. So, because we stayed in South Africa for another 4 months or so, and you know, we weren't sleeping through the night because, you know, crime is just so rife down there. Our house is broken into, like, a number of times. At one point, we had all the copper pipes, like, stolen and cut out of our house. Like, it gets so angry and frustrating down there because it just feels like you're constantly under siege. And so eventually it came a point where we decided we couldn't stay down here anymore because, like, either I was going to have a nervous breakdown or I was going to get very angry and carry out some violent retribution. And I really didn't want either of those two things to take place because, you know, despite having all these thoughts coming into my head, they all felt very intrusive. Like, I didn't want them there, but they were coming anyways. It was kind of this human response, I guess, to being traumatized. And thankfully, I did have some trauma counseling, so I had a bit of an understanding of what was happening in my brain. And so I was able to at least make sense of it. But nonetheless, it was still a very difficult place to be in. So that's kind of what led me to gaining over 100 pounds and really becoming a binge eating food addict.
Everything starts somewhere, and as you were able to pinpoint how things changed for you during that traumatic, sounds like a really riveting experience, to say the least, to be somewhere, you know, in a foreign country and just get treated that way. Did that affect how you interacted with people?
To a degree it did, but it's interesting because, I mean, I grew up in Canada, We're certainly not a perfect country by any means, but generally speaking, like we're pretty open. I grew up in Vancouver, which is quite a multicultural city. There's a lot of different ethnicities there, and so it didn't necessarily change how I interact with people, let's say, based on their race or their ethnicity. I could see how that could happen to somebody, but I think it was more a case of I had went from being like fairly athletic and active to now all of a sudden I'm obese and I feel like I'm trapped in this body. And then I started feeling like everybody must be judging me for this body that I'm trapped in, and I would take my feelings about myself and I would project them onto to other people. So I would just assume that other people saw me as this horrible sort of fat, lazy loser, rather than just seeing me for who I was, the human being. And so that did color my interactions with people. I did develop a reputation. I kind of got the nickname the Garburator, which is not a very flattering nickname, but I sort of became like the jolly fat guy. And it was a case of, we maybe go to a social event. It's like, oh, hey, John's here. We got some extra burgers or whatever. You'll clean that up, hey? And so I got known kind of like for my appetite, my voracious appetite, and my ability to eat a lot of food. And then, I think these people didn't realize they were enabling what was a really destructive behavior pattern for me because, of course, I felt so ashamed of it that, I tried to keep it hidden. Like those who are usually who are binge eaters or food addicts, like we try to keep that behavior hidden. And, many times I would try in public to, appear to eat like a normal person, and then in secret I was consuming huge amounts of food.
So it's like you were really being tormented inside, but nobody could see it. They saw you eating a lot, but they couldn't see the real torment that was going on.
Yeah. And that's, I think torment is like a great way of putting it because as time went on, I also started to have anxiety episodes or panic attacks. And I didn't really understand why that was happening at the time. Of course, I look back and I go, oh, I was, trying to run a business. At this point in time, I was back in Canada. We're talking about now about 2015, 2016. I've been struggling with my weight for a number of years now, 4 or 5 years. I was trying to run a business. It was actually a nutrition and supplement store. I was working sometimes 14 hours a day. I was trying to go to the gym for a couple hours a day. I was maybe sleeping 5 hours a night. I was using a lot of caffeine and energy drinks and things like that to stay alert. I was trying to use these stimulants to boost my metabolism, so to speak, to help burn with fat. But it really wasn't addressing the root cause of the behavior and why I was doing this or why I was behaving in a certain way. And so I tried even hiring coaches and weight loss coaches and things, and it was just this really disheartening and frustrating experience because I felt like nobody really understood. They tried to give me, here's the amount of food you should eat. And if you're not doing that, let's try and coerce you into doing that. You're making me look bad or whatever. They didn't know how to work with somebody that had the issues that I did. And to be truthful, I didn't really know what I was looking for either. I knew I had this problem or this struggle, but I didn't know the help that I actually needed. And so that can be a really frustrating place. And I think it's a frustrating place for a lot of people who might be struggling with something like this, where food plays this role in their life and they know they need help, but they don't know what that help is or what that help looks like.
It's like trying to solve our inside problem from the outside, almost also like, drop and you're searching, like you drop your keys on the inside of the house and then you go outside and looking for it underneath the car.
Yeah, I love that analogy. I'm going to remember that one. Yeah, that's a pretty accurate description of it. And so it was about mid 2017 when, kind of as a last ditch, I hired a coach. And this coach was like he was a natural bodybuilder, like he looked good. And again, I was still sort of caught in this idea that if I could sort of develop a physique like his, if I looked like him, that I'd be happy. And that's a myth. I mean, I've been involved in the bodybuilding industry, the supplement industry, and so on. And I can say that that's just aesthetics might boost your ego a little bit, but there's not happiness in that. Anyways, he worked with me in a very different way than I was expecting. He didn't judge me. He didn't shame me. He didn't guilt me for any of my struggles, which is very unusual. And it was a behavior that I was maybe not even actually prepared to be on the receiving end of, because I was sure that I was a worthless human being at this point and that I was deserving of basically being punished. And there's a lot of self-abuse that took place, sometimes even spite eating, because I was so angry at my body for not doing what I was trying to force it to do. And so he really modeled what genuine compassion looks like. And, you know, I say to people that compassion is not a get out of jail free card. It's not about that. That's called enabling. But compassion is really creating that space where you're given permission to be human and to struggle, and you're not judged as a horrible human being for having these struggles.
So why didn't you just give up? You struggled for years. You tried this, you tried that, and you couldn't, you know, you didn't find anything until you met this person and he worked with you in a totally different way than you expected. Why didn't you just give up before then? Because it could have been easy, justifiable on the inside of you. You had this horrible thing happen to you. Nobody really that could really understand you. Why not just give up?
I think that's a really, really good question. And I would say in one sense, I did give up many times. In other words, I quit on my efforts to lose weight because it did feel like it was too hard and it was too difficult. But somewhere inside of me, I hadn't given up hope entirely. Like a part of me knew like what I was capable of. I couldn't seem to shake this idea. No matter how much I tried to beat myself up and talk myself down and so on, a part of me kind of knew that I am capable of doing this. And so I would get to a certain point, I would quit because whatever I was trying wasn't working. But it wouldn't be long before I was like, no, I have to try again. Maybe I just tried the wrong thing. And, you know, it led me to trying a lot of different diets, a lot of different supplements, just a lot of different approaches, none of which involved really what I would say taking care of my internal environment. And so I think also I'd received a bit of a wake-up call. And around that same time, just before I'd hired this coach, I had to do a health assessment because I was purchasing some additional life insurance. And at that time, you know, they weighed me, they took my blood pressure, you know, they did some calculations and things, and they had to put a rider on this life insurance. In other words, I had to pay an additional portion of like a more expensive payment because I was at higher risk of dying sooner. And so that was kind of a cold, hard slap in the face that I was in such poor health for being at 35 years old at the time that I was more likely to die sooner. And because of that, I had to pay a higher premium. And so there was something in me that went, no, I'm not going to accept this as my final destiny. I'm going to fight.
When did you regain your confidence?
Well, I think that's something that took quite a bit of time, because it's one thing to kind of start seeing some success, but it took a while to believe that this success was going to stick this time, because I'd failed so many times in the past. You know, I say I've lost over 100 pounds, but I mean, we could say I've probably lost more than 600 pounds. It's just I've regained a lot of weight as well in the process. And so I would say it probably really was only a couple of years ago when I realized the stuff that we worked on was working and it was sticking and I was going to be okay. So I am a coach. I do coach other people. And I think really I'm quite a natural coach. I've been doing this in various capacities probably since I was 13. So that's more than 20, 25 years now. But it was only a couple of years ago that I think also when a coach that I highly respect, she's a really world-renowned coach, she said to me, like, you are a born coach. She said, I meet some people that are, you know, they're good technicians. They're good with maybe sets and reps or calculating macros and things like that. There's some people I meet that, you know, I hope they never become a coach. But she said, you were born equipped, like from the start, to do this. You're a born coach and you're very good. So hearing that feedback from someone who I highly respected, along with having done the work with this previous coach to really repair my relationship with myself, I was finally able to accept that compliment and accept it as true instead of just deflecting and deferring and denying and things like that. And so I would say it's kind of a, maybe that was a bit of a watershed moment, but it was a culmination of the work I'd been doing really to repair my relationship with myself, which then by extension kind of, you know, fixed my relationship with food. And I started to genuinely believe that, you know, it really wasn't me that had failed all these times previously in a sense, but rather I just tried a lot of methodologies that were just destined to lead me to failure. So it's hard to pin it down to like a single point, but I would say when that coach said that to me, I was like, okay, this is real. I've kind of, you know, I've found it. This is what I'm meant to be doing.
So you had to accept that feedback that you were good enough. Right now you're good enough. You didn't have to perform, but right now you're good enough because the bird already has flight within it, even though when it's born, you know, it looks funny and it's not strong enough and all of that, but it already had that within them. So we have to accept what's already within us and knowing that we don't have to perform, it's already there, and just express that thing that's already naturally there.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head there. It's, I look back and I just say, like, really, I've been in some kind of sort of teaching and coaching and leadership type capacity from a really young age. I kind of just naturally did these things. I didn't really think about it. I go back to maybe like when I was in grade 6, I taught two of my friends how to read, because they were seen as sort of dumb kids. And, I could sort of see it from their perspective because I was the same age, and said, well, you know, why don't I try? And I taught two of them how to read. By the time I was, you know, 13, I was captain of a basketball team. And by the time I was 15, I was playing on a senior level basketball team. And so there was these sort of leadership qualities emerging because they were kind of already there. And I look back and I say, in one sense, I don't really have any regrets about my past, but it would have been pretty neat to see if I'd had a mentor 20 years ago who saw this in me and nurtured this in me, that, you know, I could be in an entirely different place.
I agree. It's like so many people in the world today, they're not living their true potential, even though they may see glimpses of who they are at the essence, at the core level, but nobody to tell them, yes, that's true about you. And they're missing that little wind beneath their wings. It's almost like an eagle. We know eagles soar through the sky and it looks beautiful in its essence, but they're living underneath a bridge.
Yeah.
And unfulfilled, frustrated, angry sometimes because it's just not working the way they would like it to work. But it comes back to that expression of their true and core self. And sometimes it may not be someone there to tell you, to give you that little push that you need. And you have to do it yourself. You have to get it started and begin to walk. And someone may come along and give you that little wind push as you got.
Yeah. And I would add to that and say, potential is a wonderful thing, and it's a terrible thing to waste. It's, you know, it was really awesome, let's say, receiving a compliment from a world-class coach who I highly respect. But at the same time, I still had to take action on that. I still had to take steps. And I often say to people, like, the key part of maybe the law of attraction is the last six letters, which spell action. And so I think it's when we, you know, for me, it was when I recognized that I have this ability, it gave me the confidence to take the steps. So to take the actions, because now I believed I could succeed doing this, that I wasn't wasting my time. Because I think there's a tendency within ourselves that, you know, we think I'd like to try that, but I'm sure I'm going to fail. When we, or when I recognize that, you know, I actually believe I can do this now. I was taking steps forward in, you know, much greater confidence than before. And so I think we as human beings, we won't do something that we believe we're guaranteed to fail. There's kind of a rational part of our brain. So we want to recognize that if this is within us, we kind of, you know, when I mentor people, I say, start, learn, evolve. You kind of just got to start somewhere. You can't wait for things to, you know, again, it's exciting to think of our potential and what we could accomplish, but you can't get there if you don't start taking some baby steps forward. And they might be ugly. I mean, they might be ugly steps. They might be awkward steps. You're going to have to make a lot of adjustments along the way, but that's all part of the journey.
So brain-driven weight loss.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's really, I think, something that's kind of emerged from my own experience and struggles with weight loss and trying a lot of things that didn't work. And so it's a term that I've coined really to shine a light on the fact that, you know, yes, we can acknowledge that what we eat and how we choose to be active or not, they will influence our weight and our health. But it's actually the brain that drives our decision-making and our actions. And you touched on this a little bit earlier as well. So many of our efforts to create change, and let's say weight loss is just a type of transformation we'd like to go through, but they take this outside-in approach. And that type of approach fails to acknowledge our internal environment, whether that's our emotions, our mindset, our psychology, our habits. These are the things that most powerfully influence our behaviors and our results. And as you know, many of our actions, they actually take place at a subconscious or even unconscious level because of a variety of factors, not the least of which is like our brain has a propensity for forming habits from repeated behaviors. And so our behaviors are very often driven by our habits. They're also directed by our emotions, the impulses we might feel, the beliefs that we hold. And really, we could say acting in congruence with our sense of identity. You know, for example, when I saw myself as the jolly fat guy, logically, a lot of my behaviors would not have made sense to an outside observer. But if they were aware that this is how I identified in the light of that behavior, my behaviors were in congruence with my sense of identity or in alignment with my sense of identity. And I was acting in a way to reinforce that belief, that identity. So then if we want to create permanent weight loss, we have to create some kind of permanent transformation within us. And we can only really create permanent change by establishing a new pattern of behaviors, a new set of habits, a new sense of identity. And really all of this can take place because this brain has, our brain has this wonderful property called neuroplasticity, the ability of the brain to rewire itself. It's really like an exciting thing.
So it's powerful because it reconditions the subconscious mind, because the subconscious mind, once you rewire the neurons that, I think it's Dr. Joe Dispenza that says, neurons that wire together fire together.
Yes.
So we can recreate things. And it's amazing because the subconscious mind is impulsive. And once we change it, once we imprint it again for something that we really want to happen, it happens automatically. Just like the weight gain or that negative thing produces the weight, it just happens automatically. So that's the what you're talking about, is to create lasting change. Because once we get it in there and continue to go in that direction, it just adds more force in that direction, and it could keep us there.
So there's kind of two phases to this, because I really agree with what it was that you were sharing there. I like to say that compassion awareness is the first step to change. And it's not by accident that I include this word compassion in it, because of the propensity of our brain to automate a lot of our behaviors, and really because of these sort of subconscious factors that drive our behaviors, one of the first steps to change is really to bring these unconscious behaviors into our conscious awareness so we can assess, evaluate, and change them. But we need that piece, because sometimes what will happen is there's this temptation when we become aware of our negative behaviors or our unhelpful behaviors to create judgment around ourselves, or to start this negative dialogue. But when we can look at it through the lens of compassion, we just recognize that, okay, this is a human struggle that I have, but I have within me also the power to change it. Then the second piece of that puzzle is kind of going in reverse, and that is taking a helpful behavior that moves us towards who we want to become, and creating sort of a pattern of behaviors that we repeat that ultimately start to become more automatic in nature. And in that way, the more times we act sort of in congruence with the new identity that we adopt, the more sort of automatic it can become. And maybe I could give an example of this. You know, I think about the times I've driven from, you know, one place to another that I've done many, many times over. And sometimes I'll drive from one place to another. Maybe you've had this experience, and I get there and it's like, wow, I don't even remember driving here. Yes. Somehow I got here safely.
Yes.
That's the power of our brain when we can create sort of an automatic pattern of behavior. It's quite remarkable. And so in one sense, you could say we have the ability to a degree, put our success on autopilot.
Yes. And it just keeps recreating the same thing over and over again. And yeah. Oftentimes it's in a negative sense. And until someone becomes more aware and consciously aware to make that shift to create what they really want to happen, the positive change, they forever spiral in that negative pattern.
Yeah.
So I know you're a precision nutrition certified, I guess, level 2. What is that? Does that mean?
That's a year long, basically very similar to like doing like a master's degree, but it has an active sort of, like there's a curriculum component to it. And then there's actually like a coaching component to it as well. I was trying to think of the word. It's not an internship, but anyways, we have to actively practicum. There we go. That's the word I was looking for. And so there has to be an element of actually taking this theory and putting it into action as well, in order to sort of reach this qualification. And at that point, level 1 is really about the biochemistry and nutritional science, sort of the foundational knowledge that we require in order to be successful kind of nutrition professionals. But the second level, which really makes sense, the bigger degree of focus here is, how do we create change in people? How do we create behavior change? And how do we take these skills and this knowledge? Because the average person doesn't require, you know, a graduate degree level of knowledge of nutrition science in order to successfully create change around something like weight loss. They just need enough information, as well as sort of confidence that this is a process going to work, in order to take the sort of the fundamental steps. And so there's also this process of, what would I say, taking the knowledge that we've acquired and being able to sort of distill it down to a certain level. I like to say meeting people at the ground floor instead of on the 10th floor, because, you know, their priority isn't necessarily to be a high level nutrition professional. Their priority is to create transformation because maybe they want to be a better, you know, mother or father or uncle or aunt, or, you know, professional employee and so on. So they have different reasons for wanting to do it. And so PN is a really very practical, both skills-based and practicum-based approach to helping people create change, rather than just sort of, you know, vomiting information in their direction and leaving it to them to try to make sense of it.
So you mentioned earlier, you talked about one of the elements of compassion. Could you talk a little more about compassion, being compassionate to for yourself?
Yeah, and I would say as sort of a background to it, I really didn't know a lot about, or I thought I knew what compassion was, but I didn't really. And kind of in the masculine paradigm, I was seeing compassion as a type of weakness, when in fact, it's not at all. And I think it's actually quite the opposite of weakness. And so maybe I could even say that it was almost like I was afraid of compassion. I was afraid that if I showed myself a degree of kindness and understanding for my human struggles, that I would use that as a cop-out and not continue to try to change. But I found the opposite actually to be true, is that when I realized that my struggles didn't make me a lesser human being, that I actually felt inspired to try to create change, that I was allowed to be flawed and imperfect in this journey of learning and growing, that felt a lot more encouraging. Because I think, you know, we as human beings, we kind of have this dynamic tension that we grapple with. There's a part of our primal nervous system that really wants us just to be comfortable, safe, and warm. But growth itself is going to take place outside of the comfort zone. And there's a part within us, you know, I would call it our soul, that yearns for growth and development. And that means operating outside of our comfort zone. And so we oscillate back and forth between the two, this primal desire to stay sort of safe and warm, and this urge within us, this part of our humanity that makes us want to grow and develop. But to be outside our comfort zone means that we're going to struggle. We're going to make mistakes. It's all part of the learning process. And so when compassion comes into the picture, you know, for me, it meant that I wasn't getting angry at myself for making mistakes. I wasn't getting angry at myself for struggling. I actually just saw it as a natural part of the process of trying to learn a new skill set. And so compassion really enabled me to keep moving forward.
That's so wonderful, because so many people are unkind to themselves. And yeah, if you have that unsettling and that, you know, you stupid, you're ignorant, or you're no good, when you have this negative self-talk, it doesn't help. But yeah, if we even if we speak about gardening, you have to plow the ground, of course, but you have to also nurture that ground in order, yeah, for that plant to grow.
Yeah, I you know, I often ask the question, why is it, like, where even did this come from? But why is it that it's so hard to treat ourselves with compassion? And, you know, I often think, if I treated a friend or my wife, or even more importantly, my son, the way that I treated myself, how would they grow and develop? For example, I have a 7-month-old son. And, you know, I love this boy with all of my heart and being. And I think, imagine if every day I was to get up and tell him, you suck, you're a loser, you're never going to amount to anything, you're just a worthless waste of space. I mean, even just speaking those words, like, hurts my heart to think about someone ever speaking that to my son. But imagine if that's how I started my day with him. What kind of man would he grow up to be? And so then I look back and I go, but that's how I used to talk to myself. No wonder I was struggling. And so I think in one sense, it's because we can be abusive towards ourselves, and we kind of just have to take it, because we can't run away from ourselves. And we you know, in my case, or maybe I should more speak in my own personal case, and others can decide if this applies to them. But for me, it was like I could use myself as a punching bag for all of my difficult emotions. And, you know, I viewed compassion as weakness, and I was afraid to show weakness. I think also in compassion, we're going to become aware of our flaws. We're going to be aware of our mistakes. And that can really bring up, you know, painful memories or feelings of deep shame. And so there's just all of these different reasons why we seem to struggle with this idea of compassion. But I think at the heart of it is this fear of, if I show myself compassion, I won't be able to change. And yet, by the examples that we've given, whether it's nurturing a garden or nurturing a young life, there's a very good reason to believe that we can create this change. with compassion.
How can people get in contact with you?
They can go to freedomnutritioncoach.com. I think that's an easy way to start learning about some of the things that I do. The other thing is I call it a live broadcast podcast called Wellness Unplugged. And we have these conversations about between the before and after. And so you can find me, you can search Freedom Nutrition Coaching on Twitch, on YouTube, on LinkedIn, on Twitter. I'm No FN Diets. So No FN Diets. It's a bit of a play on Freedom Nutrition. Or you can just find me on Facebook, Jonathan McLernan, or my user is Canadian Nomad. So Canadian OMAD. And you're welcome to send me a friend request. I'm pretty open in terms of chatting with people.
What's your one to grow on? What valuable piece of information would you like to leave our audience with?
All lasting change starts with compassionate awareness. And when we give ourselves the space to be human and struggle, that's when we can really, truly begin to create permanent transformation.
Thank you for listening to The New Mind Creator Podcast with your host, Maurice, The New Mind Creator. This podcast has been sponsored by Abundant Sports and True Serum. Head over to www.mauriceflournoy.com to receive more motivation and insight to help create your new mind.